the feast that you're going to cook for us.
Okay. Toast, okay?
Toast? Come on! I got more expectations than that.
I probably shouldn't have said that. I'm going to get copped. I'll cop up all night, yeah?
You will.
Yeah.
I don't mind.
Me never. So
okay, where are we? Where's the rest of the crew? Adelaide.
Yeah.
And Carly, where's
Carly's gone.
Ray might be in here.
Oh, he might be.
Ray?
Yeah.
Oh, you're there. Good. Okay.
How many weeks does this course last?
12.
Oh. No, this one's just literature.
Last
one
of ethics.
Today's the 14th.
But I said I thought you said 14 weeks.
Oh no, it's 12 weeks.
Oh, just read.
Have you done any of the other classes?
Okay, we're on page 121.
121?
Yeah, 121.
Yes. We're just helping Josh out.
What's happened here? Why is
this?
No.
You wouldn't get credit.
No. If I got a diploma or a tape, but I still like my forestry too. I'm still doing my forestry.
Okay, I want to go fairly quickly. We spent sort of nice slow time going through the first couple of pages.
121. Oh, sorry.
I'd like to go quickly through these key points here. But not so quickly that you get lost. And I've also got like 10 minutes of a film to show you, which I might start at 10 to 5 and we'll play it a bit longer after that. People who want to stay on.
Now, at the top of page 21, why does it go into... I got taught this last week. It's
okay, italics.
Italics.
Okay. Now,
is that because it's full-on prose? Or?
No, it's because it's... the diary that's being written by this man, Fraser.
Yeah.
Mr. Fraser. Mr. Fraser is a botanist.
Yes.
And he writes in his diary. He writes scientific information about plants. For example, on page 117, he's writing small fig or plum with oval dark green leaves, etc., etc. He's putting entries into his field notebook.
Right.
And he's made friends with Jemmy. Fraser is another person who values Jemmy's company.
He actually loves Jemmy the most, doesn't he?
He loves Jemmy the most.
So him and Jana.
That's right. And Fraser says things about Jemmy that really go to the heart of what I think David Malouf thinks Jemmy is all about.
Yeah.
Because Fraser doesn't see Jemmy as an outsider, as an invading black person, as somebody who's, you know... disreputable, he sees Jemmy as having a special relationship with the landscape that can actually teach us something about the way we should relate to the landscape in the future.
And the flora and the fauna.
So on this page 121, about five lines from the top of the page, Fraser says, our poor friend Jemmy is a forerunner. A forerunner. Now, what's a forerunner?
A forerunner is a leader.
A leader. Someone
he's ahead
who's,
of his time.
Someone who's ahead of his time. Now, this is really important in an understanding of this book in terms of what David Malouf is trying to say about Jemmy's place in the whole configuration of colonialism and white settlement and so on. The white settlers want to push him out because he's a stranger and they don't want to have connections with anybody who's got anything to do with the blacks because they're the enemy. The children and Jock... particular, they have a different sort of relationship with him. They found that this man brings some new sort of understanding to them. It's allowed Jock to experience his life differently. He's not kind of stuck in the mold of just being with his friends all the time. He's got his own inner life.
And he can go back to what we were talking about last week.
Yep.
When he found his enlightenment.
Yep.
And Job, yep, actually can open up.
That's right.
The way he can't with the rest of the community.
Yep.
But he,
yep,
can open up to Frasier.
Yeah, that's right.
Without feeling out of place.
That's right. And to his wife in a new way.
He does, and his wife spins out on it.
That's right. So this whole paragraph, look at the bottom of page 120. Fraser writes, the theodolite. Now, you know what the theodolite is? The theodolite is what surveyors use. This instrument here, surveyors use a theodolite to carve up the landscape. And one of the great kind
first form of trigonometry.
Yeah. But the first settlers who came out here with their theodolite, what they were doing, they were carving up all the land for their possessions in terra nullius. They thought no one owned it, so let's carve it all up. The theodolite becomes the symbol of the way that white people want to carve up and own this land. So when Fraser writes in his diary, the theodolite offers only one way of moving into the continent. It offers only one way of moving into the continent. White people want to cut up farms and make properties and so on. Offers only one way of moving into the continent and apprehending the scope and contours of it. Did we not long ago, did not our distant ancestors bring in out of the great plains where they wandered, out of mere wilderness, the old coarse grasses that lapped the bellies of their horses, and separating the grains and nursing them to plumpness, learning how to mill and grind and make daily bread, and how to tend the wild vine till its fruit yielded wine, create settled places where men and women sit at tables among neighbours in a daily sacrament which is the image of the Lord's greater one. All this can be done again. Now, this is Fraser writing in his own notebook, and it's a very long-winded...
Is that why it's in italics?
That's why it's in italics. That's why it's in italics, because it's in his notebook. And what he's telling us here, he's giving his own kind of private version of how human beings have evolved from a farming culture.
Very Darwin-like, isn't it?
Very Darwin-like.
Yeah, I was just sort of
very Darwin-like. And Fraser is saying all this can be done again. Things can grow up from the grassroots. Jemmy Fairley, who's got a knowledge of the environment, a knowledge of native plants, things could grow up in that way. Bush Tucker, things could grow up in that way. So then he says, all this can be done again. This is what is intended by our coming here to Australia, to make this place too part of the world's garden, but by changing ourselves rather than it, and adding thus to the richness and variety of things. Now, this
is a very good point.
It's a very good point. Tell me what it means, Rita. Rima.
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 Well, because it's generally human mentality,
yep,
to change things to
suit us.
Their needs.
Exactly. Exactly.
Their will.
Exactly. You see, when the first settlers came out here, all they wanted to do was transform it into farming land, into cattle grazing land, or dig up the elements to produce mining. It was a culture that was underpinned by the philosophy of utilitarianism.
The Iron Age.
Utilitarianism. And utilitarianism was the 19th century philosophy. Have I spelled it correctly? Yes. Utilitarian, the 19th century philosophy that said everything had to be made useful. Useful.
Does it have an I at the end of it?
It doesn't. Thank you. No I on the end of it.
I think he meant that to be a full
no,
stop.
I didn't. I don't know. No I on the end of it. Everything had to be useful. And poets like Judith Wright, who we studied in the first week, who wrote that beautiful poem about the wattle tree, Judith Wright said many occasions that we have to let the land have its own meaning. The land has to allow it to have its own meaning. And the land needs to speak to us. We can learn from the land instead of imposing ourselves on the land.
And we still haven't learned that.
And we still haven't learned that. But we could learn it from indigenous peoples if we listen to them, but we don't.
Well, Rio Tinto and that do now.
They do. They're beginning to listen.
Especially Forrester, whatever his name is.
They're beginning to listen. That's right. So this is why Jemmy is important here. Our poor Jemmy is a forerunner. He's no longer a white man or a European, whatever his birth, but a true child of the place as it will one day be, a crude one certainly, unaware of what he's achieved, And that too perhaps is part of his intention. Yes, Colin?
It says for whana.
It says for whana. It does too. It does too. Thank you for that. That's beautiful. Thank you. I'm glad I've got... I'm glad I've got an editor here. You're employed as my editor from now on, Colin. Yay. That's fantastic. That's brilliant.
I think for whana sounds...
No.
Yeah, it's a poetic.
A poetic version. Something very funny about four funner. Okay.
He's just trying to make us have fun with
it. Okay, that's it. That's it. So, that too perhaps is part of his intention, capitalized. Obviously, the reference here is Fraser is obviously thinking God has designed it this way, that the person who's going to bring a change to Australia is someone who's going to be not very obvious. Inconspicuous, like Jemmy. That's perhaps part of his intention, that Jemmy, whatever his birth, a true child of the place, as it will one day be, a crude one certainly, unaware of what he's achieved, and that too perhaps is part of his intention, God's intention.
Oh, okay, so not Jemmy's intention.
No, God's intention, that the exemplum means the example, the person who starts something off, the person who's who embodies a new way of living in this country, that the exemplum should be of the simplest and most obvious sort. Deeply moving to those who are willing to look and to see without prejudice, that in allowing himself to be at home here, he has crossed the boundaries of his given nature. Now tell me something. Who was a person who came into this world who was just the ordinariest, most lowest of the low, who was born in a stable with cow shit underneath him? Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ was born in a stable. He was so low of the low, they wouldn't even allow him into the inn.
Just on that, can I just say, it's got nothing to do with this, but...
It might have.
No.
It might have.
There's a church up in Gosford that's got a sign at the front and says, even Jesus Christ had two fathers and he turned out okay.
That's interesting.
Right, yes.
That's interesting. Please, Josh, add. Adelaide, shush.
My dad's a Christian.
Yep.
And he studied the whole Old Testament and stuff like that.
Yep.
Originally,
the Old Testament shit.
Originally, it didn't literally say that Jesus was born in a stable.
Yep.
Originally, it said that Jesus was actually born in a house of a family.
Yep. Good. All right, that's fine.
Not a stable, but it's somehow translated to stable. I'm just saying.
No, that's a good... I mean, it's worth knowing that some facts are inaccurate, but the mythology or the story about Jesus, he was not a very important person. He didn't come into the world, you know, with clouds of glory around him. He came as a very simple person in a very simple family.
Humble,
that's the point. So it's interesting.
But that was what was so beautiful about it.
That was what, yeah. So Fraser, David Malouf threw Fraser's idea. You all right, Song?
Yes.
Through Fraser, David Malouf is sort of half implying or half seeding into the reader's mind that Jemmy Fairley is a kind of like
Messiah.
A kind of Messiah figure who's ultimately going to be executed. Or he's not executed, but he disappears. He can't cope with the way he's being dealt with, and he disappears back into the bush. So there's that kind. And then the other thing, of course, is that Janet, she becomes a nun. And at the end, she is looking after... children who've lost their parents, wayward children during the First World War. She's
but
a nun.
She uses her experiences with Jemmy.
She uses her
into those children.
That's right. She uses her experiences with Jemmy to show that there's a way forward. Yeah. And the last.
So there you are, where you come from.
Yes, please.
It illuminates Mr. Fraser as very insightful.
That's right.
And
that's
very
right.
Sensitive.
That's right.
He's the minister, isn't he?
Yeah, but he could be a really, you know, there's ministers and ministers.
But he's also a botanist who knows the landscape
very well.
He
loves the,
and has a real appreciation of Jenny's capacity to know the landscape.
And he had connection with the so-called savages.
That's right. He had that connection as well. Yes, Ray?
And when she becomes a nun, she's probably sort of reference to
fully virgin, their
yep.
immaculate conception.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
The guy of Jemmy reminds me of a real true story.
Yep. There is. It is based on a real true story.
Of a guy named William Buckley.
Yep.
Similar situation. Have you heard of him?
No.
He was just briefly.
Yep.
If you're interested, he was basically one of the convicts of a ship.
Yep.
Who got stranded onto Australia.
Yep.
And he ran away from the other convicts, and you know he couldn't be found.
Yep.
And because he was a white man, he lived in Australia, part of Australia in New South Wales,
yep.
for quite a while, and he found himself being accepted into an Aboriginal community.
Yeah, right.
And from that forward on, he'd been living with the Aboriginals for a very long time because yep. they thought yep. he was an ancestor of a previous
okay.
leader that died.
Yep.
Since then, when he came back from when he got rescued by the other British people,
yep.
missionaries,
yeah, missionaries found him, took him back to England,
yep.
and said, "Oh, we heard you lived with the scavengers."
Yeah,
he's like, "Oh no, they're not scavengers," and told him all about
savages, yeah,
and told them all about the Aboriginal heritage and
yep.
all their culture
yep.
and stuff.
Yep.
And he'll start writing a book.
Yep.
Well, actually, this other guy wrote a book about him
yeah.
and his story. So, a similar aspect to to Gemma's.
That's right. That's very interesting. Thank you for sharing that with us, Josh. Do you remember the title of that book that he wrote?
The Adventures of William. The Adventures of William.
Buckley.
The Adventures of William Buckley.
You could write a blog on that, and it would be very interesting for us to write, you know, a couple of hundred words about that, what you've just told us. It's really interesting. David Maloof probably knows about it, actually. David Maloof has written this book based on similar sorts of stories.
Not one in particular that we might know?
He will tell you next week. You can ask him that. Mm-hmm. You can ask him that.
I wonder if he knows who the first Indigenous, non-Indigenous activist was.
Whether he knows that?
Yes.
No, I don't. Do you know?
Yeah, Miss Macquarie's chair. He built the chair so Miss Macquarie could go and sit there.
Yep.
And admire and watch the natives go about yeah, their thing.
Yep.
And she went back to her husband and said, "We can't do this, we've got to get out of here. We're killing it, we're destroying these people."
You're right.
And then he said, get in the boat, see you later.
I thought Mr. Macquarie
was the very first non-Indigenous activist, man.
Yeah, is that right?
Was she married to an Aboriginal?
No,
she wasn't. Who was the guy that was the Sydney guy, the Sydney Aboriginal person that was married to a non-Aboriginal person?
So it was a colour, it was the collar system.
Don't know.
The collar was on.
There was a person, especially down near where Mrs. McQuarrie's chair is.
Yep, yep.
There's a famous Aboriginal guy. He's got a right near the harbour. He's got a painting. He's got a painting on the floor
yeah.
of his Aboriginal artwork, which
right.
faded away. I can't
right.
remember his name.
Is it rock art or is it? Or
it's,
is it?
It's no, it's painting. It's actual paint.
Yeah.
It's not rock art. It's just
yeah.
painted on.
Well, there's another blog for you. We'd like to hear these stories. It's really interesting connections
he's
you're
very
making.
Popular. He's a very popular. He's a very popular Aboriginal guy.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't remember his name.
Okay. All right. We're going to move on now, folks. We're going to move on to Janet McIver, and we're going to go to page 53 first. Page 53. Now, this passage on page 53 is a kind of a foreshadowing. And this foreshadowing is a literary technique. We're here, Ronan, page 53. It's a prelude. Yeah, you could say a prelude or a foreshadowing.
Oh, look at that. That's right.
And something happened.
A
hint of things to come. Listen to this. We're three paragraphs from the top of the page. This is about Janet when she's, you know, in her. Probably her
yeah,
late
just before
her adolescence. She pored over books, anything she could lay her hands on that offered some promise that the world was larger, more passionate, crueler, even that would be a comfort than the one she was bound to. So she's got great aspirations and great imagination has gendered.
Why would she want to go to something cruel?
Where is it? Okay, thank you.
Just
for adventure?
No. Well, add a dimension to it. Add a depth to it, cruelty.
Maybe
because she lives in a box.
Because it's so boring.
Yeah, boring.
Even
if it was cruel, it would be better than this boring. Yeah,
maybe the cruelty is used in a different form of context than what the word means.
So anyway, she's got sort of aspirations and ambitions to be something beyond just a little girl, something beyond just a housewife. There's something in her. That's right.
Maybe she was looking for Blake Eye.
For a black eye.
Yeah.
No, a black guy.
A black
eye. You know, like some women like.
No,
cool.
Oh, I don't think so.
What's up?
Janet's a good.
Come on, man.
No.
Next paragraph.
Not a cool pot. No.
She sat over a piece of simple needlework and worked as if her life was in every stitch, as if one day the angel of the last judgment would hold up the potholder with its design of forget-me-nots, point to a stitch that was too small or not straight, and say for the whole world, all the gathered souls of all the ages to hear, Janet McIver, did you do this?
Sounds like my mother.
She's making a little potholder. One day, hunched, so obviously she's very hypersensitive to criticism and wants to do her best. She's a very intense kind of nature. One day, hunched in the shade of a scrubby lemon tree, picking idly at a scab on her knee, she was amazed when the hard crust lifted to discover a colour she had never seen before and another skin, lustrous as pearl.
That reminds me. I used to love picking scabs.
There you go. But that phrase, lustrous as pearl.
Skin underneath.
That's right.
I used to pick them so they never heal.
Well, listen to the rest of it. A delicate pink. It might have belonged to some other creature altogether. And the thought came to her that if all the rough skin of her present self crusted and came off, what would be revealed shining in sunlight was this finer being that had somehow been covered up in her.
Because she'd been stuck
in this country and bound by it, and she wasn't able to express herself the way she wanted to, you know?
Yep.
And she wasn't comfortable with who
that's
she
right,
was.
That's
and she's
right.
Heard all the stories about the old country.
Yes, yep.
Yeah,
yep,
and
yep.
she can't remember it.
Yep.
So
Josh?
That description, her thinking about snake skin.
Like a snake skin, exactly.
Yeah, like
sloughing off a snake skin and being completely renewed.
And pure.
Okay. And then the next paragraph, when she got up and walked out into the paddock and all the velvety grass heads blazed up, haloed with gold. Grass heads blazed up, haloed with gold. Blazed up the grass heads, haloed with gold. Reminds me a little bit of Jock McIver when he walked out into the field and there were the grass heads with all the beetles on it. She felt under the influence of her secret skin suddenly floaty, as if she had been relieved of the weight of her own life, and the brighter being in her was very gently stirring and shifting its wings.
Explains everything.
Good.
She was hunched over picking scabs because she was found some pot and an attitude.
this is also, she's becoming a young woman, isn't she? How...
Now Adelaide's onto the money.
Yeah.
She's becoming a young woman.
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay. Okay, now go, Josh.
Is this talking about further on, as the time goes on, like now?
It's like now, she's wishing and hoping or imagining that this scab that she's picked off is suddenly triggered in her imagination, this wonder and this wish.
Was this before the whole encounter with Jemmy?
Oh no, this is after. This is during. This is while Jemmy is there.
Jemmy's still there.
Jemmy is there, and Jemmy's presence is not a direct presence, but with Janet and with Jock, her father, he's having this influence on her.
They're learning by osmosis.
That's right. That's a lovely word. Rima.
Looks like Janet naturally was like that.
Yeah, it does look like she was naturally
spiritual.
Wanting to change into some other form.
It's almost like caterpillar.
Yeah.
Chrysalis caterpillar.
Transformation.
A butterfly.
That's right.
Yeah. Into a butterfly.
Now we're going to go here now, folks. We're going to go here to page 129 and 130.
Oh, very good bit.
And Jemmy's here. Okay, this is 129. Halfway down 129.
This is where Jemmy says how he feels as the community treats him.
Nope, this is a different bit.
Oh, that's it. Yeah, like, yeah.
It was on a day not long after Jemmy had moved into the little room there, so she was no longer a beginner. They had finished their work with the bees. She had put off her bonnet and veil. The day had been unusually oppressive, steamy, and for the last hour a dull sky had been glowering bronze with a greenish edge to it that bruised the sight. Look at these descriptive details of the environment. Amazing.
A big northern storm's coming.
That's right.
Wet season.
Yeah, that's right. That greenish tinge.
Yeah. Wet season's coming.
Suddenly there was the sound of a wind getting up in the grove, though she did not feel the touch of it. And before she could complete the breath she had taken, or expel it in a cry, the swarm was on her, thickening so fast about her that it was as if night had fallen just like that in a single cloud. She just had time to see her hands covered with plushy, alive fur gloves before her whole body crusted over and she was blazingly gathered into the single sound they made, the single mind. I want everybody in this room now to go. So she's in the middle of that. Her own mind closed in her. Her own mind closed in her. She lost all sense of where her feet might be, or her dreamy wrists, or whether she was still standing, as she had been a moment before, in the shadowy grove, or had been lifted from the face of the earth. The bees have their stomachs full, her mind told her. They will not sting. Stand still, stand still. It was her old mind that told her this. She stood still as still and did not breathe. She surrendered herself. You are our bride, her new and separate mind told her as it drummed and swayed above the earth. Oh, so that is it. They have smelt the sticky blood flow. They think it is honey. It is. Mrs. Hutchins was only feet away. So was Jemmy. She could hear their voices calling to her through the din her body was making. But it made no difference now, the distance, 3 feet or 1,000 years, no difference at all, or whether she was a girl, a woman, or a tree. She stood sleeping, upright, a bride. Note these very short sentences suddenly. Sleeping, upright, a bride, dramatizing this complete stillness, this sense of her, a bride, being changed, transformed from one thing to another through this experience.
And then it goes into a massive long one.
Then the bitterness of smoke came to her throat and the cloud began to lift. And there, through the gaps in herself, was Mrs. Hutchins with coils of smoke pouring out of her sleeves. And Jemmy, open-mouthed with a frame in his arms. And the bees, one by one, then in fistfuls, rolling off her, peeling away like a crust, till she stood in her own skin again, which was fresh where the air touched it, and only a few dozen foolish creatures were left that had got themselves caught and were butting with their furry heads and kicking in a panic at being alone. She felt Mrs. Hutchinson's hands on her skin now, which was quite clear and unharmed, but seemed new to her. And all through Mrs. Hutchinson's fearful ministrations and Jemmy's whimpering cries, she remained a little out of herself, half sleeping, regretful, her 2 feet planted square on the earth. Years later, she would become expert beyond anything Mrs. Hutchins might have dreamt of at the bee business. She would know all the breeds and crossbreeds and create one or two new ones, actually bring them into being, whole swarms that the earth had never known till she called them. She would devote her life to these creatures, bringing to the daily practical study of their habits and all the facts and lore that is the long history of their interaction with men, a bodily excitement that went back to this moment under the trees when her mind had for a moment been their unbodied one, and she had been drawn into the process and mystery of things. For it was not the bees themselves that had claimed her. They had been only little winged agents of it, the little furry-head armed angels that might, if she had panicked, have stung her to death, martyred her on the spot, a solid silly giant that had stumbled in among them. All that was still to come. For the moment, still numbed by the shock of what had struck her, she moved to comfort Mrs. Hutchins, who had sunk to the ground and sat like a rock gone suddenly soft, and sobbed and took a good while to get her breath. "Don't be upset, Mrs. Hutchins," she said, feeling the older by years, though her voice was unchanged. "The bees didn't hurt me. I knew they wouldn't. I remembered what you told me, and it was true. They didn't sting." She saw then from the look on Mrs. Hutchinson's face that though her own faith had been absolute, Mrs. Hutchinson's had not. So it had been that had saved her. The power of her own belief, which could change mere circumstance and make miracles. She went, half dreaming, and looked at the hive, all sealed now, a squared off cloud, still drumming, that had once been clamped to her skin, a living darkness, so that the only light came from inside her, from the open space she had become inside the skin they made of living particles, little flames. She had remained cool inside, and when the flames drew off, what was restored to her had a new shape, was simpler. She had emerged with a new body, which the world, and this was the point, had dealt with to its limit and let go, and which from now on, however things might appear, it could not destroy. She was rather surprised, really, that she did not appear changed to Mrs. Hutchins, since the body she was now standing in, as her mind saw it, was not at all the old one. She looked past Mrs. Hutchins to where she had stood just a moment back, and what she saw was not herself, not a gawky child in pigtails and a faded frock, but a charred stump, all crusted black and bubbling, and she saw it. This, when she met his astonished look, was what convinced her, through Jemmy's eyes.
Now that's a bit confusing.
Yeah, no. Her and Jemmy had some kind of telepathic understanding.
So she's the charred stump.
Because Jemmy can see the spirit within people. He doesn't look at the flesh.
Yeah.
Jemmy sees something different in her. Jemmy sees...
He sees the change that just took place.
The change, and he sees not a girl in pigtails and a frayed frock, but a charred stump, all crusted black and bubbling, which, as I think Rima has nicely suggested, can be another version of her. But what we've heard... Go, Josh.
I was just going to say, it's very interesting in this chapter how there's one part of the section of this chapter where he talks about peeling off the skin again.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly the point.
In the other one, there was also peeling off the skin.
That's exactly the point. You've made the connection beautiful. You've linked the two together. That's what I wanted you to do, to see that the skin peeling off was a foreshadowing or a prelude to this event where perhaps the most important...
Transformation.
The most important thing is she's completely surrounded by, let's do it again, she's completely surrounded by that, but she maintains this deep stillness inside, this deep stillness, and she becomes almost one at mind with the bees. And it's like there's some kind of deep transformation takes place in her that separates her from her old self. And in fact, we get one clue to it. She's become an adolescent. She's had her first period. That might be the cause why the bees have come. That's the explanation at the top of page 130. They have smelt the sticky blood flow. They think it is honey. It is. So that might be the kind of scientific explanation as why this has happened.
It's going to the minds of the bees now when they're saying it's honey. Oh, wow, look, it's honey.
That's right. They are attracted to this. Perhaps that's
it's
one.
Pheromones that the females.
Pungent.
That's it.
Smell.
Yeah.
That's
just
it.
So, just say so some people know when Aboriginal. That's what Aboriginal women went.
Secret woman's business.
It's secret woman's business. It's kind of yeah, but when females in the before settlers came, females, when they went through menstruals, all the young girls were sent away, but
yep.
they'd always come back with honey.
Very good.
Oh, that's interesting.
Very interesting. Mm. So the last part of the novel we're looking at is page 180 to 183. And this is where Janet, now as an adult, many, many years later, is a nun in a monastery. And this last page, we're going to read just from page 181. She has in her heart a kind of prayer for Jemmy, for everything. She remembers that event at the beginning that we looked at the first thing today, with the dog jumping up and seeing Jemmy. Everything is kind of embraced in her imagination. David Malouf kind of brings this book to a beautiful closure, and he actually talks about it as a kind of praying, and it is a kind of praying. Let's read it, 181. When she glances up again, for she has been dozing, the misty blue out there has become indigo. Darkness is falling. The first lights have been doused, though the houses themselves do not fade from her mind, or the children who are sleeping in them. She's caring for these children in the outlying houses. The first bright line of moonlight has appeared out on the mudflats. Her monastery is looking out over the mudflats somewhere in Queensland. Marking the ever-moving, ever-approaching, ever-receding shore. All this a kind of praying. It does not make a house any less vivid out there because she can no longer see its light, or the children any less close because they no longer come to visit, or Willie because she's never known him except for what she has felt in Lachlan and through him in herself, the wedge of apple in his mouth, or her mother, long gone, standing out on the hill slope in the dark of her body solid through the flimsy stuff, the moonlight of her shift, or her father slumped at the breakfast table, the loose skin of her mother's hand like an old glove on the leathery back of his neck, or in the darkness now on the other side of the house, the single mind of the hive closed on itself, on its secret, which her own mind approaches and draws back from, the moment of illumination when she will again be filled with it. And Mrs. Hutchins, who has led her to this, and always in a still moment that has lasted for years, Jemmy, as she saw him once and for all, up there on the stripped and shiny rail, never to fall, and flash, slicing the air with his yelps in clear dog language, and his arm flung out, never to lift him clear, overbalancing now, drawn by the power, all unconscious in them of their gaze, their need to draw him into their lives, love, again love, overbalanced but not yet falling. All these, Lord, all these, let none be left in the dark or out of mind on this night, now, in this corner of the world, or any other, at this hour, in the middle of this war, First World War. Out beyond the flatlands, the line of light pulses and swells, the sea in sight now ruffles, accelerates. Quickly now it is rising towards us, it approaches. As we approach prayer, as we approach knowledge, as we approach one another, it glows in fullness till the tide is high and the light almost but not quite unbearable, as the moon plucks at our world and all the waters of the earth ache towards it, and the light, running in fast now, reaches the edges of the shore just so far in its order, and all the muddy margin of the bay is alive, and in a line of running fire all the outline of the vast continent appears in touch now with its other life. Well, that's a huge mouthful. That's a prayer in which Janet is kind of bringing all the components of her experience together. Jemmy up on the fence, the bee swarm and the way that's changed her life, memories of her mother and father, the dog, everything kind of coming together, and her sense of the sacredness of all that. And she's the kind of carrier of the richness and value of that into the future, even though Jemmy has gone.
And also she's maturing from that.
Yeah.
From the
very beginning. She's grown up.
Yeah.
That's right. Now I'm going to show you a little bit of this film about David Malouf, which is a beauty. The film lasts an hour. I'm not going to play an hour, but just to give you a little heads up of what it's going to be like when David Malouf comes here.
Or is it like a lecture down there?
No, no, it's not a lecture. You wait and see.
My study partner went to a thing.
Yep.
It was... the discussion was on David Malouf.
Yep.
And it was all these different people saying what they thought, you know, David... It wasn't actually about Beyond Babylon. It was another book. And that what they realised that David Malouf was actually sitting in the crowd and he stood up and he goes,
what are all wrong? God knows what things have happened here and gone unrecorded by men or are on the way towards us.
Is that too loud?
Will we ever know the true history of it? The secret history stored away in the dark fold of the landscape and its scattered bones of paradise found or lost.
Now, when we talk about history, of course, what history really is what is told and recorded. But of course, what is told and recorded is only the smallest part of what happens. And, you know, when we talk, for example, about 40,000 years of Aboriginal history in Australia, almost none of that is recorded, but a great deal happened. And it seems to me that fiction is always interested in all those parts of life, of ordinary lives, and there are many, many of those that never gets into the history books. They're not involved with large events at all. They're involved with the ordinary, mundane things of living from day to day. And fiction, therefore, tells a different story from the story that gets into history. It's a story that allows people to enter into what happened imaginatively, the way large events may not.
He was speaking of poetry itself, of the hidden part it played in their lives, how it spoke up for what is deeply felt and might otherwise go unrecorded. All those unique, repeatable events, the little sacraments of daily existence, movements of the heart and intimations of the close but inexpressible grandeur and terror of things. That is our other history. The one that goes on in a quiet way under the noise and chatter of events and speaks immediately out of the centre of each one of us. Shape to what we too have experienced and did not till then have words for. Though as soon as they are spoken, we know them as our own.
One day before publication. Thank
you. David Malouf is one of the world's leading contemporary writers. He's published 8 novels, 5 collections of poetry, a collection of short stories, and 2 libretti. He's won numerous prestigious literary awards, including a shortlisting for the Booker Prize in 1995, and in Dublin recently, his novel, Remembering Babylon, was judged the best book by anyone, anywhere, in any language, in the last 3 years.
The winner of the 1996 International Impact Dublin Literary Award is the man we have all come here to honor tonight, David Malouf.
This is his book about Ireland, which I'm teaching at uni at the moment, Curlow Creek.
A sorrowful land, with the fine rain, thin as smoke, blowing in from the Atlantic so that the taste of it was there on your lip. The smell of it in sheets that had been laid over a bush to dry. Salt and sorrow over the fields. Sad country. mortal, made human by the long sorrows it had endured. The sorrows yet to come.
I think that there are five or six people writing in English now.
Famous Irish novelist.
Still writing novels, who are not producing blueprints for movie scripts. I suppose they are Toni Morrison, V.S. Naipaul, Nadine Gordon, or Jerry McCoatsay, John McGaughan. And I certainly think that David Malouf is among that group of very special novelists left in the world now, still writing novels where the language is beautiful, where the characterization is superb, which are mysterious still in their shape, which are not led by politics or ideas, but are led by the sense of character, the sense of form. And certainly as a reader, anything that those five or six novels would produce would be fascinating now.
These art books would wear the intimacy of the relationship.
Famous South African novelist.
And sometimes they're so magical that you don't want to leave
this
people with the novel and take them home. You know, I think that's what's... And when you find a body who can do that to you, you know, as a reader, it's...
The thing about Malouf's imagination is we'd all like to have it. That's the secret. He's doesn't need to forget anything. He's got a great gift of assessing the actual tone and rhythm of speech. He's inward with the English language in the most extraordinary way, as if he was reinventing it. And without too many verbal quirks. I mean, he's not a Joycean writer in that way. The words are what they always were. Just the combinations are unique. It's the Maloufian stamp. And it's when a writer is actually characteristic for us in simply the way he lays out a sentence that he starts becoming a classic, in my view.
Well, this is a city I was born and grew up in. I lived here until I was 25 and I ran away to Europe. But it's a city that I hardly recognize now. How are you still wandering around in that lost city, that submerged city? And I mean, an awful lot of your emotions are involved with meetings you had at particular street corners, times when you waited hours for people who didn't turn up at particular street corners. So that city is a map of your experience, as a map of your emotions, as well as everything else. And if you're a writer, that's what you're continually going back to, and so the emotions are still recoverable. The city's recoverable only really in memory. I have a very, very good memory, which is photographic to the extent that I see what I'm remembering very, very clearly. It's also inaccurate. And I mean, I quite like the fact that you have an inaccurate memory, which is also very, very visually clear.
Experience. A complex history comes down to us through household jokes and anecdotes, odd habits, irrational superstitions. Its spirit resides in ordinary objects that become, beyond the fact of presence and usefulness, the characters in a private language, characters too in the story we are living. We hear our first folk tales with a style of recognition, since what is enacted in them is general to every society, even the smallest. And our own has already revealed to us the magic that glows along the threshold or round a forbidden biscuit tin.
And my mother's parents were both dead when I was growing up, so I didn't know either of them, except from the rather grand photographs I was always shown of them, and from the stories my mother told. My mother, who'd left England when she was 10, went on living in that English world she'd come out of. My father's parents came to Australia separately. They came from the same town, in fact, in Lebanon.
I don't ever remember him speaking any English, and I used to be quite fascinated by the fact that he spoke another language, and he would often be telling long stories to people who were sitting there and laughing. I've no idea what those stories were. And I used to sort of eavesdrop on them and felt that I understood what they were about because I could hear the tune.
The old man's stories are fabulous beyond anything I have retold from the Greeks. But savage, a form of extravagant play that explains nothing but speaks straight out of the nightmare landscape of this place and my dream journeys across it. They fill the world, they make the head buzz, they numb the blood. They seem absolutely true and yet they explain nothing.
My father was a Roman Catholic and we were brought up as Catholics. I mean, he was very much a mother's boy. He bought a house that was two doors from his mother's. I mean, he lived with us, but his mail was always delivered at what he called down home, which was at his mother's. He went down there every evening after he came home from work and spent at least an hour with my grandmother. My mother and my grandmother had a very, very shaky, not to say hostile, relationship. I don't ever remember that she ever crossed the threshold into our house. And that area that people in Brisbane call under the house is something that's peculiar to the domestic architecture of this city. A lot of children found it a very scary place. I certainly did.
Down here is the underside of things. The great wedge of air on which the house floats, ever darkness. The stumps of a forest of which the house, with its many rooms, forms the branches. A place whose dimensions are measured not in ordinary feet and inches, but in heartbeats, or the number of seconds you can endure the sticky, soft lash of cobwebs against your mouth, or the weight of your body at kneecap and palm on crunchy cinders.
It's mostly dark. Sometimes there's a tool shed under there. What's almost always under there is everything that has fallen out of the house. So, you know, endlessly as a child, if you had lost a bit of a jigsaw puzzle or a screw or a nail that you were particularly fond of, where you went and looked for it was under the house because it's probably fallen through the boards. It was also a place where you went to be alone, to sulk. Also, it was a place where people went to experiment sexually. I mean, little boys and girls playing down there, that's where you found out an awful lot that was possible in that space that wasn't possible up in the house.
September the 3rd, 1939. Germany strikes, calls total war upon Poland, and Britain is plunged into the inferno of the Second World War. The call goes into the far corners of the empire. It's the Cannon Call. A mighty empire of 500 million responds.
Well, we always listened to the war news at home. It became a great feature of everybody's life, and I and auntie used to sort of come up and, you know, 8 o'clock in the mornings, she'd be shouting at the bottom of the stairs, "Have you heard?" Whatever it was. And the thing that I can remember very well is her coming up one morning and sort of shouting from the bottom of the stairs, "Belgium's fallen." I had no idea what the fall of Belgium meant. It was a bit like Humpty Dumpty. And I remember going to school, and I had a friend called John Malpas, who was the same age, and there were little tiny stools, only about 4 inches high, and I was sitting on one of these, and he came and sat beside me and said, "What's the matter?" And I remember saying to him, "Haven't you heard Belgium's fallen?" as if it was some sort of, as if it were part of a domestic crisis rather than anything else.
When I crawled into bed at night and my father came to put out the light, the war took on its real form. Hitler and Mussolini, those historical bogeymen that even adults believed in, burst in upon me, bearing their terrible paraphernalia of barbed wire, bayonets, tin helmets, hand grenades. The purpose of quite simply to reach up over the foot of my bed or down into the pillow and drag me into the pallid black and white world of newspaper photographs and newsreels. A world without colour, like the night itself, in which everyone was a victim, pale, luminous, with flesh already frazzled around the edge, and where being a child with curly hair and apple cheeks that everyone wondered at was no protection at all.
One of the most popular forms of entertainment in those years of the war were the newsreel theatrettes. They showed only war news. They ran the program ran for about an hour. There was a huge turnover of people. But essentially, that notion of what war was like close up came first with those newsreels.
The year 1942 opened on a dismal note for the Allies. The troops in Malaya.
Okay, we'll stop there. It goes on for another 45 minutes, but you've got a taste here of David Malouf's life background. When he comes here in a fortnight, you'll be able to talk to him about his mother and father and his sisters and where he lived and what his interests are and so on. So, yeah, that's it for today. Thank you, folks. There's blog topics up in the blog, and I'm going to see you all at the steps of the art gallery next week at 2:30.
I'm sure they're next, my last person,
next
in for, so you can see him before Monday.
Sorry, what's that?
I'll make sure that the last week's person, this person will be before Monday.
Okay, lovely. Thank you, Neil. That's great.
Michael?
Yes, Josh.
I've got something for you.
Yep.
I didn't give you something upstairs.
Okay, I'll be here for the next half an hour.
Okay, and also, yep. What are we meeting here for next week?
On the steps of the New South Wales Art Gallery. In Art Gallery Road, behind St Mary's Cathedral, but I will put a link how to get there. I'll put that up both in my blog and in Leo.
That's the Art Gallery with the big statues at the front.
That's the one with the big statues at the front. Yeah, okay, good. Opposite the Domain. The assignment is due.
The one we went to visit the bridge.
2 weeks' time.
Assignment?
I didn't go.
Blog topic.
Michael, thank you.
I'll see you, Patricia. Bye bye.
You'll probably find it.
You will.
Okay,
I won't go away. You only have to write 100 words on what you see in the art gallery. It'll be pretty easy for you, that will.
It's can just that be one of them?
Sorry?
Can that be one of them?
Oh, that will be one of them, yeah. It'll be one of your blogs, yeah.
Where's the recording? The 11th.
I missed last week the recordings.
Oh, really?
Yeah, last, but I'm going to put them up tomorrow when I get back to uni and I've got a fast internet connection.
Because that was the one that was relating to
Remembering Babylon. Yeah. I will put it, I don't know why I missed it.
Zoas just help you rephrase a book, so like when you're going through the book and you don't understand something, go back to the Zoas, look at those things, sing, and then you think, oh yeah.